You're listening to episode 321 of Women Worldwide. The word resilience is used a lot today. What does it mean to you? My special guest has a lot to share about her journey and resilience, so stay tuned to learn more. Hi, I'm Deirdre Breckenridge. I've spent an entire career helping women to share stories, nurture relationships, grow their brands, but most of all, to find their voices so they can make a difference. Do you feel stuck? Do you want to power up your own voice? Women Worldwide features the stories of passionate women who have navigated big career challenges and some of the toughest changes. These professionals offer deep insights and advice to inspire you and to help you uncover what's holding you back. Let Women Worldwide ignite your passion so you can excel in life. Hi, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Women Worldwide. Thank you so much for being here, for tuning in, and for showing up, and for always sharing. You're helping to grow this network, and we appreciate you. All right, I want to get right to today's topic because we have a lot to go over. The topic is resilience, and we're going to break down the word resilience with the author of a new book. Joining me on the show is Emily Rapp Black, and Emily is the author of her new memoir called Sanctuary. And Sanctuary unpacks the various notions of resilience that we carry as a culture. So we're going to go over this with her. But first, I also want to mention, this is not her first book. She's written Poster Child. And she's also written The Still Point in a Turning World. I hope I got that right, Emily. You can correct me. Her work has appeared in many publications, including, I'll just give you a sampling, The New York Times, The Wall Street Journal, O Magazine, Vogue, The Boston Globe, The LA Times. So that's just a few. And Emily is also an associate professor of creative writing at the University of California, Riverside. I could go on and on, but I think it's time that Emily shares her thoughts with you. Emily, welcome. Welcome to Women Worldwide.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Well, it's such a pleasure, and we throw around this word resilience all of the time, so the opportunity to break it down with you is a really good one. But before we go into that, maybe you could just share, did you always know that you were going to be an author and that you would also teach creative writing? How did you get there?
I did not know, because in my family, that's not really a job. you get a job. Yeah, you go to 9 to 5.
Yeah, job. Real job, Emily.
Yeah, right. No, I mean, I was always an avid reader, and I grew up around story. My dad is a Lutheran pastor, and he was always creating stories in his sermons, which I actually would rewrite and then not tell him. And so he'd be like up there like, what? Pretty great. And so I've always been a storyteller. And so I think I didn't know I could do that with my life until I went to college and I was thinking about going into academia. And then I took a creative writing class and I thought, oh, this is much more my speed. I really like it. I feel energized by it. And then later when I went to graduate school for something completely different, I did another creative writing class and I was like, okay, the writing's on the wall here. This is what I need to be pursuing. So that's, I mean, I didn't always know, but I always knew, like, for example, I was not good at math. So I was not going to be... Like, I mean, I wasn't going to be in business. Like, I don't have that kind of a mind. So I've always been drawn to humanities. So it was always going to be something like that, a kind of storytelling. Yes.
I love that. I mean, just the fact that you were changing dad's sermons and you had this writing bug or gene within you.
Yeah, poor dad.
And writing found you completely. Now, your new book, Sanctuary, is a memoir. I mentioned that. And maybe you could just share the main message or the big takeaway that you want readers to get from this book?
Yeah, I mean, resilience is a, you know, it's thrown around so much. I mean, we hear it, it's about skincare, make your skin resilient. It's about your kids, make your kids resilient, your community, yourself, especially in the pandemic, like how to be resilient. And I was hearing that a lot after my son died and I was pregnant with my daughter, who's now 7. And I was just like, what is happening? Like, what I think I responded to was people were saying, oh, you're so resilient. And then the next was, you're so strong. And what I realized was that they were collapsing those two words. And resilience is not actually about just pure strength or powering through or grit or whatever you want to say.
Right.
It's actually in us. It's our birthright. We are all resilient because human beings are designed to find a way to live. So the takeaway is you don't have to work hard to right. do it. You have it. You just have to acknowledge it and activate it. You don't have to do anything, which I think is nice. There's so much to do.
My goodness. So this resilience and not pairing it with this strength and knowing that it's inside you and being able to tap into it, how do you find that? What are steps to tap in? And does the book talk about that?
Yes. Yes. Okay. I mean, I think the sort of the only step is to look at the world, mm-hmm. honestly, to look around in the world. So resilience, the root word of it is resilin, which is a Latin word. And it means it basically refers to the stuff in butterfly wings, the stuff that the gooey stuff that keeps the wing parts together. I'm obviously a scientist. And so, you know, it's like, if you look at a butterfly, if you grabbed a butterfly, you could easily sort of shred it, right?
Right.
But it's also flying around pretty fast and mm-hmm. Flies long distances. And so it's a combination of sort of break to bend. Another example I use in the book is Viking ships. I became completely enamored with everything Viking. And
from butterflies to Vikings.
Butterflies to Vikings and everything in between. So in Viking ships, when they would choose the wood, they would not choose the strongest wood, like the wood that would be sort of rigid or perform with the most strength. They would choose the wood that would get easily battered so that it would shift with the water. And that way it would go more easily and it would adapt and shift. So it's kind of like if you've ever been not chosen for kickball, because you're not the strongest one. It's like choosing the
kid. Softball.
Exactly. Everything, right? You're standing against the wall, I'll never be chosen. So I think that was really interesting to me. So it's the materials that can warp the most sort of readily that are the most resilient because they have an ability to shift and adapt and change. Power through. Yeah.
Right. So that definitely begs the question about the whole unpacking notion and society and culture. Does society and culture help us to adapt and shift and change? What?
I mean, I think it depends on your positionality and where you're coming from. I can only speak from my own sort of very singular experience as a woman. I'm a woman with a disability. I'm a mom. I'm a teacher. I don't think there are a lot of cultural supports for us to recognize our resilience. I think we are really pushed to be, and this is obviously a huge generalization, like men. So just like work, 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 like this very masculine model of productivity. And then we're like, oh, good job. You know, you're so strong. You're so productive. You're so resilient. But resilience isn't like that. It's the image I like to think of and why I chose Sanctuary as the title is that anything that you are inside of, the world, your body, a moment can hold you like a sanctuary. And it's a very quiet strength, if you will. And it's not about pushing to the top, right?
Right.
Just like, I'm going to do this. You know, it's not like the Nike. Like there's time for that. Like I love athletics. I love those messages for those purposes. But I think in terms of emotional life and just life in general, it wouldn't be real.
It couldn't be all the time. There's no way.
Yeah. So just changing and sort of looking at a situation being like, okay, this is what it is. So now what? How am I going to accept it? And how am I going to make the most of it or the best of it without this there doesn't have to be like a warrior cry.
Right.
Prior to that, yeah.
Because you mentioned loss, mm-hmm. and with loss and grief, you have to sit with it. And that's not a moment where you're like, yeah, I'm going to do this and I'm going to be strong. No.
Yeah.
It can be crushing. It's traumatic. Mm-hmm. And it's more about how you're going to move forward and shift and adapt. And mm-hmm. that's really important in those moments. Is that a part of your book too?
Yeah, I think a part of it is about being vulnerable,
yes.
being kind of open to being split open. like being right. open to being heartbroken or flattened mm-hmm. and knowing that in those moments okay. you can ask for help. That's part of being resilient, or you can not be okay.
Right.
And you have to, I mean, it's kind of a cliche. It is a cliche, like ride the wave or whatever. But I mean, I do think you have to say, well, okay, how am I going to survive this? And it's very, mm-hmm. it's basic like that. I mean, grief very much feels like that. You're like, how am I, what is, how will yeah. I do this?
Minute by minute.
Yeah. Minute by minute, second mm-hmm. by second, year by year. I mean, it changes, yeah. but it doesn't go away. So curiosity is a big part of that. Like being curious about how you feel, I think, and yes. Compassionate. Finding people who can truly support you and not sort of create a distance, like saying, oh, I would die if I were you, which is my least favorite thing that people say to yeah. me. Or, you know, I couldn't do it.
Right.
You know, I don't know how you do it. How are you still alive? Like, it's those are strange things to say.
Right. Not, also, certainly not helping to shift and move and morph yeah. and change mm-hmm. in a positive direction. And people mean well, Emily. I really believe that people mean well. Mm-hmm. It's just everybody's different, and you have to know who to surround yourself with, just mm-hmm. like you said. Do you think that society is helpful when it comes to feeling that loss and grief, or does it help or hinder?
I think maybe there's been a kind of shift in perspective due to COVID, because mm-hmm. death is sort of always in the news yes. in a way that can't be avoided. And it's not in another country, it's here. And so, and other countries everywhere. So I think that's brought it to the forefront. I don't think we're very death literate in this culture. We're very afraid of it, and we try to pretend like it won't happen. And then right. when it starts to happen, like, you know, there's just everything goes south. So I think what can be helpful is, you know, finding communities within the culture that are kicking back against that in some either subtle or, you know, grandiose way. For example, I run a class, writing class for women who've lost children, and we've been together for about 2 years, and it's like the most phenomenal group. I can't imagine what my life would be like without this like weekly or bi-weekly group. I mean, we write, we talk, we have a WhatsApp chat, and it's like everyone's at a different stage of grieving. Everyone's from a different kind of walk of life, part of the country, part of the world. Everyone has, you know, had a different kind of child loss, but we have a shorthand, an emotional shorthand. It's like, oh, this happened today, and people can sort of offer their, you know, support or right. you know, just encouragement. It's amazing. Like that's amazing. Yeah, that's building resilience, because you know that you can like sit down somewhere and someone will support you. With a text or an email or a hug. Well, when we hugged people. And I
a virtual hug.
I know, right? It's like, oh. I also think another question that I was asked a lot, and that a friend of mine asked me, my friend, the writer Sarah Centillas, who I've known for decades, would call me and say, how is your grief today? Mm-hmm. And that I thought was really helpful.
It's a good question.
Because mm-hmm, it
don't
changes
hear that often.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's another thing people can use. How are you today?
Right.
And then the person might be like, I actually feel pretty good, and be like, great. Because then there's right. guilt that comes with feeling but good when you're no longer grieving. So it's, you know, there's always another step in the process.
Are the women in your group, are they all phases of loss, or some mm-hmm. have had new loss, and others maybe years ago have had loss?
All of that. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Some 20 years ago, some, or even more, 30 years ago, some, you know, last year. Some with multiple child loss, different kinds of loss, accident, disease,
sure.
stillbirth, there's mental illness, death by suicide, everyone. There's like just, it runs the gamut of, you know, there's not every single loss you can imagine, but it's very diverse.
Which is really helpful.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
For mm-hmm. grief and loss and mm-hmm. just hearing others' experiences and mm-hmm. knowing that somebody else has been through something and they can really relate. Mm-hmm. So, no, that's wonderful that you're doing that. Have you had any big aha moments that maybe you might want to share? A big learning moment that's really stuck with you?
I would say that, I mean, I'm always talking about my loss group because it's like the work of my life. I feel like when I first convened them, I was like, this will be fun. I teach so much. I teach a lot. I teach many students. I teach different kinds of students, like all over Zoom, all over the world. And I thought, okay, this will be great for a weekend, right? And then I realized that it's like the continuation of a community that continues on and on and morphs and changes. And I should know that, given that I grew up in a community and I've always had like an army of female friends. But that was an additional aha, like, hello, like, of course, you know, this
here to stay.
Yeah, right. But just like that's, you know, those are the relationships that really sustain people. The ones where you that don't have, like, you don't live with the person or you're not raising a family with the person. There's someone who's just sort of chosen part of your life all the time. Not that a partner wouldn't be, but they're there in a different way. And I think that to me, it's continuing revelation how powerful friendship is, mm-hmm. and how little we talk about it as a sustaining primary relationship.
That's fantastic. You have a lot of people around you, mm-hmm. and helpful and learning through experience. Do you have certain mentors that you've relied on, especially with your own writing, because you are an accomplished author? And isn't one of your books, is it the Still Point of the Turning World, that's like a best-selling New York Times mm-hmm. editor's pick? So do you have mentors who have guided you in your writing?
Oh, sure. I mean, I went to graduate school. I had many really generous teachers. My favorite and best teacher was David Bradley, who's a novelist. And I also admire so many different writers, like Elizabeth McCracken is sort of the writer I always wanted to and still want to be. She's just everything about her and what she does and how she moves through the world. I have my friend and business partner, Gina Frangello, who reads everything that I write and is very honest. It's like, this was boring.
It's so good you have to have
And then I also have my editorial team, which is my editor at Random House, and my agent. And those two people are just as responsible for anything I actually manage to finish as much as I am, because they're very, you know, they know me, and it's an ongoing, again, and it's an example of an ongoing relationship that evolves. And even if the projects are not the same. Yeah.
Interesting. This just popped into my head, but it's going back to, because you mentioned all the people who have influenced you, there's been different books that you've published. Does resilience, is that something that comes when you need it, or do you think it's just always there? Are you always showing your resilience?
I think it arrives when you need it most.
Yes.
Like, you know, it's like the one of the good gifts when you go through a crucible experience or difficult experience, like, wow, I didn't know I could do that. And you're not pushing or striving to do it. You just like do it. It's like I think the analogy is, you know, when if a mother or father sees a child under their child under a car, they like lift the car. Like they're not thinking like, I can lift this car. Like it bypasses analysis and just goes straight to the core of it. So I do think everyone is resilient. I think some people don't think they are, mm-hmm. and then surprise themselves. I think sometimes people think that they need to do something to be resilient, and you don't. You just have to be in a body. Which to me was a great relief.
Last time I checked.
Yeah, last time I checked, here I am. So I think it's like, you know, that's why I think the natural world can be such a source of solace, because it's sort of cleaned of any sentimental, like birds aren't like, how long am I going to live? You know, they're just doing their bird thing.
And I think their thing.
That's
butterflies too.
Yeah, yeah. Even whatever life cycle of any kind of insect or animal, they're not overthinking, as far as we know, right?
Exactly. How do you? Okay, so I know that there's probably certain times that you like to write, and you feel creative, or you're doing your teaching. Mm-hmm. How do you kind of stay focused and manage all of this?
I do short sort of like what I call rocket writing, or 10-minute spurts.
Rocket writing.
When my son was alive, he was bedridden, obviously, because he couldn't move. And I sat in bed and I would do like a 10-minute session, and then I would have to give him a medication or do something related to his care, or teach or go off somewhere. So 10 minutes. Yeah, 10 minutes. And I like to call it like writing with intention, or time under tension, like you would in an interval class. Like it's like 10 minutes, you have one thing to do, you execute mm-hmm. it, you're done. So I do that, and it really helps me. I'm not someone who very rarely will I sit in front of the computer for 4 hours and just be lost in my, you know, I mean, that happens to me maybe twice a year when I just sort of am like, oh, like the muse just hit me, you know, but it's not something I think that many writers feel a lot, or I don't. I give myself a task, a very simple thing mm-hmm. to do. I do it for 10 minutes and then I'm done.
Do you write in a journal or is Rocket writing on your computer?
Computer. I don't write in a journal because for mm-hmm. me, journaling becomes just like the contents of my headspace, which nobody wants to read.
Emily, we really might want to read it.
I used to do this experiment with my undergrads. I would bring like a journal of mine from junior high and I would read it and I'd be like,
oh no.
It'd be like a dog whistle went off. They'd be like, this is the worst. I'm like, this is why I don't want you to keep a journal.
So I think
you say to yourself, like, okay, I'm going to write a scene mm-hmm. where this happens. Boom. And you do that. So you give yourself a task, not a prompt, but like a thing mm-hmm. to do or a prompt, and you do it for 10 minutes instead of just like waiting to be inspired or sitting there. Like people don't get inspired and they're not creative when they're white knuckling their computer.
Right. You get excited when you talk about teaching. So you must.
I do like teaching.
It totally comes through in your energy. That is amazing. Well, Emily, I can't even believe it, but we're getting to the end of our discussion. So if you would, maybe just some final words, parting advice to everybody out there about their resilience and what they can do and what to keep their eyes on when they need to move through some mm-hmm. tough situations that happen.
Yeah. I would say they need to keep their eye on the world and just to see that the way that the world works. I don't mean like the human built parts of the world. I mean, just seasonal things, animals, plants. Like, I'm not arguing to go sit down and like watch a plant grow, but just like getting rid of the analysis of everything. And I think I told you at the start, I have a fourth book coming out in June called Frida Kahlo and My Left Leg, which is about Frida Kahlo and my left leg. And because my left leg is artificial. And she was an amputee as well. And people are always saying about Frida Kahlo, like, she was so strong. She was so resilient. In fact, she was in a lot of pain most of her life. Mm-hmm. And she managed to paint mm-hmm. in her bed, on her back. Oh, and she painted goodness. Herself. And I think that there's something about that self-reflexivity that can be, you know, like kind of staking your claim in the world in a non-violent way. I think she did that really beautifully. And I think just saying to yourself, like, well, I will find a way. That's what I say to myself when I'm having a hard time. Like, I will find a way. There is a way. I will find it or it will find me. And then just stop stressing about it if possible.
That is great advice. I will find a way or it will find you. It's so true. That's awesome. Emily, where can people find out more about you, your current books, the new one that's coming out? You have a lot going on.
I have a website, just my name, emilyrackblack.com, super creative. And I also have a business with my friend, the writer, Gina Frangello. We do like manuscript editing, we do classes, we do retreats, we do intensives. And that is, we're called Circe Consulting after the goddess Circe, of course, who was like a sub goddess. And then she went into a cave and like came up with this magical potion. So our approach is that, you know, writing is transformative. So we work with a lot of different writers at different stages of their careers together. And so that's where you can find more about me.
Excellent. And what about that group that you mentioned? For anybody who's listening or watching, if they've experienced loss and they need a support system and they're mm-hmm. interested in writing, where is that?
They can always just contact me. I have one group now. I might start another just to make sure that they remain intimate.
Yes.
But I think that's been really a magical thing. And there's also ways to find, I'm thinking just about child loss. There's a Courageous Parents Network. There's the community called Modern Loss, which is online and they have a book and I'm a part of that. Lots of resources there for people if they don't want to write or if they just want to write mm-hmm. a little bit. So there's a lot of things that are free, some things that aren't, but there are a lot of things they can just access online and reach out. So yeah, I'm happy to talk to anyone who is interested in some of those resources and how they access.
Thank you. That's great information. And you are an inspiration. Really appreciate you being on the show, sharing your journey, breaking down resilience for us. So thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Well, It was great to have you on the show, and a big thank you to all of you for tuning into Women Worldwide. Please keep the conversations going and the feedback coming. You know where to find me. I'm at Dee Breckenridge on Twitter, and you can also find me on LinkedIn, connect with me, or even email me, Deirdre at pureperformancecom with two M's.com. Okay, thanks, friends. Please be safe, stay energized, focused, and empowered.